Okay, so, yeah, we're trying to figure out what happened in the beginning of the universe. And basically, I'm going to be talking about misconceptions that we often teach our students, especially the most defenseless of our students, the ones taking undergraduate survey courses. And so I'd like to, clarify a few points about what we mean when we're talking about cosmology, and then also I want to talk about some misconceptions that have been widely distributed and talked about in the Joint Dark Energy Mission, JDEM, aka SNAP, formerly known as SNAP. And since I'm going to the Science Definition Team meeting, I'll be showing you a few things about that. Okay, so Newton's Law of Gravity. Gravity is the most important force in the universe. And gravity is an inverse square law force. And so you need to know the distance d. You can't have an inverse square law force if you don't know the distance d. So we need to be able to define a distance. And that is then a source of some problems. So the distance, what is the distance? So we spend a lot of time talking about how far away things are, and so that's the distance. But what do you really mean by the distance? The distance is the spatial separation at some time. Any other definition just doesn't make any sense. So the distance is the difference in the spatial separations taken at a common time. And so certainly the distance is not the position of one object minus the position of another object at a different time. That's not the distance. So that just wouldn't make any sense at all. And then the recession velocity, we can define that. The recession velocity is just the change in the distance with respect to time. Okay, so this is all pretty straightforward, pretty obvious, but then it gets into trouble when we start talking about special relativity. So special relativity says that the concept of simultaneity, right, the position of two objects at the same time, can't be defined in an invariant way. So what you need in order to define the distance doesn't really work in special relativity. And time dilation comes in, and you don't have any kind of universal time. I mean, you have some kinds of universal time, but the moving clocks run slow. So Einstein needed to replace Newton's inverse square force because he couldn't define the distance. I mean, that's what really set him to thinking about this, as far as I can tell by my reading. So the distance in the inverse square law just wasn't definable in special relativity, so he needed to do something else. And general relativity was the result, and I'd just like to point out that general means invariant under general coordinate transformations, and that, of course, is the source of a large number of confusions. So under Galilean relativity, which is the basis for Newtonian mechanics, Aristotle said if you have a space-time diagram, well, he didn't talk about space-time diagrams, but here we have a space-time diagram of an eraser sliding along the chalk tray and coming to rest relative to the blackboard. Galileo pointed out that on a moving ship, now we talk about a spaceship, but here it was a sailing ship, the eraser comes to rest not with respect to the world, but with respect to the ship, so that only relative motion mattered. So the Galilean transformations, Galilean relativity, you're taking this space-time diagram. Imagine drawing it on the deck, on the side of a deck of cards. Maybe 52 cards isn't enough, but take 8 decks, 400 cards or something. And then you can just stack them up and then take a magic marker and draw your space-time diagram along the edge of this pile of playing cards. And then you can take a straight edge and skew your deck of cards so it's skewed like this, and that's a Galilean transformation. So the cards slide horizontally, and that means that delta t is not changed by this. So any time interval is not changed. So under Galilean relativity, it's easy to define the distance. But when Einstein came along, he was saying, well, if we take this situation where we have two events, A and B, that are both connected by light rays to this first event, if we then shift under Galilean transformation into the frame of reference of this observer, we end up with the two events being simultaneous, but now the rays of light are traveling at different speeds. And the speed of light is given by Maxwell's equations as the ratio of two physical constants. So you have 1 over epsilon naught, which is the strength of the electrostatic force, divided by the electromagnetic force, mu naught. So if the speed of light is going to be a physical constant, then it can't be different for these two different rays of light. So Einstein ended up having to mess with the time. So you have to introduce a transformation of time into the Galilean transformation in order to keep the speed of light constant. But that means you can't define in an invariant way what the distance is. And so that led Einstein to think about general relativity. So now I'm going to be talking a lot about light cones, because as astronomers, light cones are what we see. And so here are some light cones, you know, sort of a fancy three-dimensional light cone here. And here's a very abbreviated light cone. Now, this speed limit of 300,000 kilometers per second means that the world lines of any particle, you know, the actual path of any physical particle with mass has to be inside the light cone. So it has to come from inside the past light cone and depart inside the future light cone. But once we get into general relativity, these light cones don't map onto themselves. So if you take, you know, xt and map it into x prime t prime using a Lorentz transformation, all the light cones transform into themselves. And that's no longer true in general relativity. And this is, again, the source of a bunch of confusion. And of course, general relativity allows a general transformation. So if I take a couple of particles moving along straight lines here, and then I've drawn the r theta grid, and then if I just plot r versus theta, it's sort of like a space-time diagram. And now you can see they're both following curved paths. They have the same curvature, that is the same acceleration. And this is the basic idea of gravity under general relativity, that you have geodesics. And so any geodesic, you know, through a given event with a given tangent vector, those geodesics will then be identical. So particles will have the same acceleration. Okay, now let's apply this to the universe. So what do we know about the universe? Okay, through observations, we have learned that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. So here's a not isotropic, but homogeneous brick wall. So the bricks are laid, there's always bricks. You know, of course, there's a long axis and a short axis, so it's not isotropic, but it's homogeneous. And then here we have an isotropic pattern around the center, but it's not homogeneous because it's only isotropic around one spot. So this is all based on observation. This is empirically derived evidence. You know, actually, Hubble started measuring the isotropy of the universe and now got some pretty good evidence for it, but nothing like what we have now from the cosmic microwave background. So Hubble was measuring galaxy velocities, well, actually, many people were measuring galaxy velocities, and he found that more distant galaxies, that is, fainter galaxies, had higher velocities. So this was kind of a heroic effort, because some of these redshifts that he got took 7 days or 7 nights of exposure on the 100-inch telescope. But the basic point that the velocities increase with distance, and they increase linearly with distance. This was not very obvious from Hubble's first data, but you know, it was a correct inference that he made from that data. You know, it's very important. Okay, so that's one of the facts of the universe. Well, if we have this situation where galaxies are in this relatively smooth flow, where we can actually see that the recession velocity of a galaxy is proportional to its distance, this implies that there's a very simple pattern of velocities in the universe. And this is all from observation. And that's what allows us to actually define a cosmic time, because we don't have to worry about the fact that moving clocks run slow, because all the clocks in a given neighborhood are all moving in the same velocity. So It turns out that the Hubble law is only true in one frame of reference, which is the co-moving frame. Otherwise, there's some constants. If you look at Hubble's original paper, he started out fitting for those constants, which is exactly like the dipole anisotropy of the microwave background. Harder to measure, but it's the same term. So once you know those constants, you know where you are relative to a co-moving frame, and we know that we're traveling at about 370 kilometers per second relative to a co-moving frame by looking at the cosmic microwave background. This is an actual measurement from FIRAS, where you're measuring absolute temperature of the microwave background at each spot. And of course, our COBE color scheme had the hotter areas of the sky as red, and so that corresponds to a blue shift. And the cooler areas of the sky corresponding to a red shift were blue. Okay, so that's a little backwards, but because we know how fast we're moving or how fast a co-moving observer is moving, we can actually define the cosmic time. And that's very important because then we can actually set up a simple description of the universe. And remember that general relativity allows you to use any old description of the universe you want and gives you the rules for transforming from one to another. But one of them is going to be simpler than the others. So if you want to be, you know, working, only 80 hours a week, then you should use the simple description. Okay, so I'll just point out a few things. The linear law, velocity versus distance law, is universal. So here's a linear velocity versus distance law. It's a space-time diagram, of course. And if we transform to B's frame of reference, then B's in the center, A is now moving away from B instead of vice versa. And if you pick this up and plop it down on there, you get exactly the same pattern. So you transform from one co-moving observer's frame of reference to another, you have exactly the same pattern. And that would not be true for any other velocity distance law. So if you have a quadratic velocity distance law here, if you transform from A's frame of reference to the B's frame of reference, these patterns are not identical. So if you had a quadratic velocity distance law, you could easily tell what was the center of that law. There's only one center that could have that law. And so that's not universal. It's not homogeneous. And the other thing about the velocity distance law being linear is that when things expand according to this law, you don't distort the pattern. So if you start with a picture of me, you end up with a picture of me. Whereas if you have a quadratic velocity distance law, you start with me and you end up with grizzly atoms. Or you can have a velocity constant. This is sort of the explosion model, and then you just end up with a big hole in my head. So if you're not going to distort the pattern of the universe, then you have to have this linear velocity versus distance law. And that means you have a homologous expansion going on, and that's important. So the velocity then has to be exactly proportional to the distance. And as we all know, the distance in most models of the universe goes to infinity, and therefore the velocity goes to infinity. And if you don't agree with that, then you want to use coordinates where it's harder to figure things out. So if you want to do it the hard way, it's possible, but the easy way is to say the velocity goes to infinity. Okay. So we want to use the proper time since the Big Bang for co-moving observers as the time variable. This is the cosmic time that we can define. And then we can use radar distances where we send light pulses out and get them back to figure out the distance of a nearby galaxy. But because of that, of course, the light cones have to tip over. When you're looking at the radar measurements made by a galaxy that's moving away from us, the light cone around that galaxy tips over, so its central velocity is exactly the same as the velocity of the galaxy. So the light cones are symmetric about the world lines of co-moving observers. So here's the linear velocity distance law again, and here it is decorated with light cones. Okay, so the light cones tip over. See, here's a tipped over light cone. And of course, that means that we have to have velocities greater than c because the universe is infinite, so we can keep going on out, at least if the universe is infinite. We can always find a distance great enough so that both sides of the light cone are tipped over beyond the vertical. And that means the velocity of expansion is greater than the velocity of light there. At least that's what you have to say, because the velocity is the derivative of the distance with respect to time, and if you waited 10 years, that object you're looking at might be 20 or 30 light years further away. And so then we can draw in the light cones all over the space-time, and we get this kind of pattern. And here's the past light cone. You can get this by integrating a differential equation, or you can just draw a curve that's always parallel to the little light cones here. You can see there's always the same angle there. It's always parallel to the edges of our little triangular light cone. So that teardrop is our past light cone, what we can really see. And then when we want to do a transformation to the frame of reference of a different co-moving observer, now what we have to do, we do have a cosmic time, so that means we can go back to our deck of cards, and each card represents a different cosmic time. We can draw the space-time diagram on the side, and then we can skew it over. But we have to skew it over not with a straight edge, but with a curved edge. In fact, that shape of the edge has to be the world line of a co-moving observer. And that's the transformation we have to use in order to do things simply, unless you want to do things in radial coordinates again. So here's the omega matter equal 2 model, which is a closed universe, of course. And in this case, the radius of the universe is C over H, so it sort of fits together rather nicely. So we can draw the co-moving, you know, the light cone, I mean the world lines of co-moving observers as radial lines, and here's the past light cone in this coordinate. Notice you, in this particular case, you can look halfway around the universe. So the universe has a radius. You're not looking all the way around it, but you're looking halfway around it for omega matter equal 2. And of course, being in this polar diagram, it's very easy to transform from one observer's frame of reference to another. You just spin the big wheel. So here I have tabulated for different models, omega matter, omega lambda, the maximum V over C in the universe, and the V over C at Z equals infinity. Because this is one of the misconceptions. It turns out that usually V over C at Z equals infinity is bigger than 1. So I had to go pretty far to find a model where that was not the case. So the maximum V over C is always infinity except for a closed model. But the V over C at Z equals infinity is infinite for the Milne model, for an open universe, for the Einstein de Sitter universe, for the WMAP universe, and the de Sitter universe. It's only equal to 1 for a universe with omega matter equal to 6.4. Nobody believes that model. Okay, and I'd just like to point out that I haven't mentioned inflation at all until just now. So this has nothing to do with inflation. Inflation is not what makes the universe expand faster than the velocity of light. It's just it's a homologous expansion and the universe is infinite. So here's that Milne model again, the empty universe. And it's possible to draw this space-time diagram in the coordinates of special relativity, and then it looks something like this. So these hyperbole are now constant proper time since the Big Bang, so those would be horizontal lines here. And then we get this kind of space-time diagram. This teardrop becomes a straight-lined light cone. This is much more difficult to figure out what's going on than this. But on the other hand, it's just special relativity. So the velocity is tangent of the hyperbolic angle psi, which runs up to plus and minus infinity. So there's many, many ways of defining a distance, or at least a quantity with the dimensions of distance in the universe. And so what I've plotted here is some of the ones we actually measure. Those are in red. So the angular size distance, the luminosity distance, and the redshift. All of those are measurable. You know, you need some calibrations like the luminosity of the object or the size of the object or the Hubble constant. But those are ones we can actually measure. And then there's another couple. You know, one that people always use or almost always use and I'd like to stamp out is the light travel time. So when you read in the popular press about the distance of some object, people are almost always talking about the light travel time. And the light travel time just has a number of bad aspects to it that make it unsuitable for any kind of work, even press conferences. And then there's the current distance, the distance now, which of course is the integral of the metric along t equals t naught. That's the real honest-to-God distance in which the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, which follows the Hubble law exactly, and so on. So I think that's what we ought to use, but except for the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, they said, you know, one of their distant quasars was 27 billion light years away, and that was brave of them, and I think wise. Okay. So different models, of course, have different runs of these luminosity, these distance-like quantities with respect to redshift. And based on this, this is how we've decided that the universe is filled with dark energy by measuring these deviations. But I'd just like to point out what's wrong with the light travel time distance. It's dUmb. Okay, so this is the distance now. This is actually for the WMAP flat model, omega matter of 0.27. And so it's a nice homogeneous and isotropic coordinate system. And this is the z equals infinity circle. Of course, the universe keeps going on and on and on, but the screen on my computer does not, so I stopped. And then if I plot light travel time distance instead, you get this. Notice that it's not homogeneous at all, and it's not isotropic except at the center, so there's nothing particularly good about it. And it violates the Hubble law, so if we plot the light travel time distance, its derivative with respect to time versus h naught d over c. So this should be a straight line. It's not. Well, it is for the Milne model, but that's the only case that it is. You'll notice that this light travel time distance can go to infinity for the de Sitter model, but not for anything that has a big bang. So it's a complicated thing. And so it's often used in press conferences for no conceivable reason. But it seems like people imagine that they can get out the door before people, you know, the audience asks this question. So if we can see a quasar 1 billion year after the Big Bang, and it's now 12.7 billion light years away, that's the light travel time distance, then the obvious question is, how did it travel 12.7 billion light years in only a billion years? Well, the answer is things go faster than the velocity of light in the universe. And then if we're going to say that, we might as well say the thing's 27 billion light years away. That's perfectly reasonable, because that's how far away it is now, and that's what a real distance is. And so if you want to calculate any of these things, don't want to figure out how to do it, I recommend my cosmology calculator, which actually I could run live, but I won't. That's just a screenshot. But this shows a calculation of the age of the universe for the WMAP model, 13.7 gigayears. So now another one of the questions in the quiz was whether, you know, the universe is expanding because space is expanding, or whether the galaxies are moving. And the answer is, it's up to you. You know, those are different coordinate systems. Use whatever you want. Do the simplest thing. They're both exactly the same. So the redshift is a Doppler shift, or just the effect of the expansion of space. Okay, well, general relativity allows you to calculate the redshift, and it doesn't really care what system of coordinates you use, but, you know, your metric can be more messed up or less messed up depending on how you do it. So you can use fixed co-moving coordinates with expanding space, or proper radial distances with Doppler shift. Both will work. What will almost never work is this special relativistic formula, so don't use that. So here's a cluster, a bound cluster of two galaxies in this expanding universe, and you'll notice they're orbiting around with a constant period. No change in, you know, the cluster's not expanding, it's just moving. And if we wanted to do that in the simplest possible way, we'd shift over to the center of gravity of the cluster and just analyze it. By Birkhoff's theorem, all this stuff outside doesn't affect the gravity inside, so, you know, it's just a simple two-body problem. And if it's three galaxies, then it's just a simple three-body problem. Well, there's not really any simple three-body problem, but, you know, you can work it out. Now, we could just plot this in co-moving coordinates if you wanted to, but then the radius is decreasing in the co-moving coordinates. And so that's not the simplest way to figure this out. Okay, now I'm going to be showing some space-time diagrams in what are called conformal coordinates. I've been showing you space-time diagrams like this for the universe, and that corresponds to this side view of the Earth. This is a southeast course and a southwest course. And of course, ultimately, they wrap around the South Pole many times. But if we go to a Mercator chart, which is a conformal map of the Earth, then you can make these straight lines. That's the advantage of the Mercator chart. And you can do the same thing in the universe, and then it stretches out like this, except in the universe, at least for the Einstein de Sitter model plotted here, you only go down a finite distance, whereas in the Mercator chart, the South Pole is at minus infinity. So this definitely simplifies matters when talking about certain aspects of the universe. Okay, this is a nice little animation. This shows the balloon analogy of the universe. And you can see the photons of the microwave background are the little snakes, and they're gradually getting redder as the universe expands, and their density is going down. But unlike the wavelengths of light, the galaxies are not expanding. So the galaxies are just bound systems, and they stay the same size. So the actual percentage of the universe filled with galaxies goes down. This is an important point to make. And so there's a well-drawn balloon analogy. You should glue coins or buttons to your balloon instead of drawing on it. So when you blow up the balloon to show the universe expanding, the actual galaxies do not change size. Okay. Now, just a little historical note. I recently found this because the NASA ADS system introduced full-text searching. You know, those guys are doing the greatest things for all of us, you know, by putting all these articles on the web. Well, with full-text searching, I was actually able to find a book review that Fred Hoyle wrote of a book written by George Gamow. And it's very interesting. The reason I hadn't seen it before is it's not indexed under Hoyle as the author. So, but, you know, his name's in there, but he's not the author of it. You know, it's just all the book reviews were in one article entry, so it's not well sorted, but at least the full text got this. So here's the 1940 measurement of the CNR1 line. This is sort of the first clue that there was a microwave background. So this is the Zeta-Ophir absorption line, big, broad thing. And these narrow interstellar lines, you almost never see excited states for interstellar lines. But here's an excited state. And Hertzberg said, from the intensity ratio, you get a temperature of 2.3 Kelvin, which has a very restricted meaning. Of course, you know, that was the second Nobel Prize flying out the window. He already had one, so I guess he doesn't really need two. But, you know, Fred Hoyle could have used the Nobel Prize. So this is the book review. This is the quote. You know, people always say that, you know, the CN observation was never connected to the whole cosmology question. It's not true. Hoyle wrote this in a book review of Gamow's book. So Hoyle knew about it, and Gamow had to have read that book review. The Big Bang model would lead to a temperature of the radiation at present maintained throughout the whole of space, much greater than McKellar's determination for some regions within the galaxy. A crucial test of the model. Now, Gamow, you have to back out of that book. You know, it was T naught of 11K in that book. And Alpher and Hermann, you know, actually calculated this much better. And they normally thought 5K was right, and that was in the Nature paper. But they had a PhysRev paper where they said, well, it's 5K. Or it could be 1K, we don't really know. Both would work. So the Big Bang model definitely predicted a temperature here, and it could have been 2.3 Kelvin. And nobody followed it up, at least not until after Penzias and Wilson. And then it was followed up, and here's that primitive observation, and here's a modern observation. 2.73 plus or minus 30 millikelvin. And so except for the FIRAS measurement, that's just about the most accurate measurement you got. So that's, you know, the fact that people always say nobody followed it up, that's fiction. You know, it was sort of perversely ignored by Hoyle and Gamow, who preferred to argue than to go measure. Okay, then we have the CMB anisotropy. This was measured by the COBE satellite, the DMR experiment. And Stephen Hawking said it was the discovery of the century, if not of all time, which is just a great blurb here. So I want to thank Stephen for that, coming later. So not measured by COBE was an interesting effect that's now very important. And this has to do with the fact that there's two fluids in the early universe. Most of the mass is in dark matter. We know that. And dark matter doesn't interact with light, and it doesn't interact with itself, and it doesn't interact with baryon. So effectively, it has zero pressure. It's not moving. Cold dark matter is not moving much. So zero pressure, and that means zero sound speed. It's got density, but no pressure. And then the baryon photon fluid, most of the density of the baryon photon fluid is, in fact, photons. And so that means that the speed of sound is approximately the speed of light divided by the square root of 3, 170,000 kilometers per second. And so we're going to have two different kinds of behavior in the early universe. One is it will have traveling sound waves. So if you have an overdensity in the universe, it will be traveling as a sound wave. And then we'll have the dark matter not moving. So associated with the dark matter is the gravitational potential, because it's most of the density. So the gravitational potential in this, this is an underdensity here. So it has a negative, it's a positive gravitational potential. It's a negative gravitational potential. But anyway, so that makes the temperature hotter. So it's red. This is still on the DMR scheme. And so as a result, up here in the blue areas is where the clusters of galaxies form. Those are the overdensities. But if we can successfully go backwards, for the correct wavelength, we can move that a blue area onto the red area here, and then we can get a positive interference between the effect that denser gases are hotter with the effect that denser gases have gravitational potential wells, which makes the temperature look cooler. So we can get positive interference. So interference at last scattering. And then this produces the Doppler peaks in the angular power spectrum of the microwave background, which are properly called acoustic peaks. And so this position of this first one is now measured very precisely to about 0.5%, and that allows us to determine something about the universe. So from the amplitude of the peaks, we can determine the baryon density, the matter density, and then from the position of the peak, we can find out about the vacuum density. Early in the universe, any vacuum energy density was insignificant, so it doesn't really have any effect on the shape of the power spectrum, but it does affect what we see, and that's the angular scale. So all of this stuff is, going on at a scale that's less than the COBE resolution. The COBE resolution was 7 degrees. And sometimes higher angular resolution gets you the secret of the universe. So anyway, that's in Kendall Square, Cambridge, Mass. That's where the cold dark matter is, so I found it. So in order to measure that, NASA built a satellite, WMAP, and launched it in 2001. Of course, many people built ground-based experiments, Phil Lubin among them, and balloon-borne experiments. Again, Phil. I guess, Phil, what would you call a South Pole experiment? Is that more balloon or more ground? Cold. Definitely cold. Okay, so this is the WMAP experiment going up. And here's a very significant aspect of WMAP. It's the NED control. And so since 2001, I've been feeling much better. Okay. So it had 5 frequencies. And here's the maps in our new green, blue, red color scheme. But if you want to see them in the old COBE color scheme, you can look at my tie. So it's got 5 different stripes and repeating patterns, and those are all the maps. Okay. So from these, we can make a map with the galaxy at least reduced. And then this is almost all cosmic microwave background fluctuations, and we can learn a lot about the universe. And you can see that off the galactic plane, the different bands show almost exactly the same temperature fluctuation. So it's a gray variation from dark gray to light gray. In the galactic plane, the longer wavelengths are much brighter. So you get a red or pink galaxy. Well, the position of that first peak, first acoustic peak, is determined by two different parameters. If you have an open universe, then in this hyperbolic space, you see smaller angles here. And if you have a vacuum-dominated universe, if the universe is expanding faster and faster as we go forward in time, that means it's expanding slower and slower as we go backwards in time. And therefore, the actual time back to a certain redshift is bigger, the distance that the light has traveled is bigger, and therefore the angles are smaller. So either an open universe or a vacuum-dominated universe will have smaller angles. And as a result, we've measured one parameter, which is the position of the acoustic peak, and we're trying to fit it to two parameters. So we've got one data point and two parameters, and then we get a degeneracy line here. And it's commonly asserted that the cosmic microwave background data shows the universe is flat. Well, this is the flat universe line, and this is what we actually show. So it's somewhere between a flat vacuum-dominated universe and a closed super-sanded universe. So this with no vacuum density is down at a matter density of 1.3 and a Hubble constant of 30. And that's a perfectly good fit to the microwave background data. Just as good as the fit up here, which we all believe. Somewhat in between, there's a best fit, but it's not good enough to make me believe it over, you know, the fact that we have all these extra parameters. We can also learn a lot from the depths of the troughs and the heights of the peaks, and primarily what we're learning about is the primordial power spectrum, power law spectral index, very close to what inflation predicted, and also the baryon to photon and dark matter to baryon density ratios. We know the photon density. So that means we can figure out the baryon density. It's 0.42 yoctograms per cubic meter. That's my concession to the SI system. And the cold dark matter density is 2.1 yoctograms per cubic meter. And I'll show some plots where I have a little omega. That's the critical, you know, that's the density divided by the critical density for the Hubble constant of 100. And so it's divided by 18.8 yoctograms per cubic meter. So here's little omega baryon. These are the models that are consistent with WMAP. And this is the Big Bang nucleosynthesis value from David Teitler's D over H measurement in primordial quasar absorption lines. So it's quite consistent. And this is the cold dark matter density. So the ratio of these two is 5 to 1. You know, it's 5 ± 0.5 to 1. So it's not quite well enough measured to actually say whether it's an integer or not. That would certainly be an interesting fact if it were an integer. But we don't know. And our crazy lambda CDM model with its dark matter and dark energy and all that still fits the data very well. Okay, now what about supernovae? So supernovae have come up with some very interesting results. And Rees et al., and, you know, this, well, it's no longer this year, but it's only 11 months ago. Big table of 185 supernovae. And then, you know, they've made a number of claims from this data. But, you know, what you can really show is that, you know, it does fit lambda CDM. And if you want it to fit anything else, then you need to do something. But they can't rule out evolution based on just the supernova data. Doesn't matter if you're measuring supernova at a redshift of 1.7. You can't rule it out because just really dumb, simple models of evolution fit the data perfectly. So there's also another point, you know, they talk about a crossover where you can point to this graph and say that, you know, now the universe is decelerating as opposed to accelerating. Well, yeah, the universe is doing that, but it's not related to that crossover. So here's the graph in question. So these are the bend differences in the distance modulus between that empty Milne model, which is certainly convenient, and it makes this plot very easy to see, and the WMAP flat dark energy model, that magenta solid curve. Now that's not the best fit. A closed dark energy model is a better fit to the supernovae, but it's got too many parameters and not enough better fit. And here's an evolving supernova model, is the dashed blue line. So it's extremely close to the concordance model, so you can't really rule it out with supernova data. It's a better fit, actually, but not significantly better. So a whole bunch of models. But what we can basically say for sure from the supernovae is that between a non-accelerating model and the decelerating models that everybody thought were right before the supernova results came out, those are all wrong. We have to have the supernovae fainter at moderate redshift than they would be in an Einstein de Sitter model or even in the Milne model.
Yeah, but you assume in the evolving model?
What?
What did you assume
in the model? Oh, I'll show you in a bit. You know, next few slides show that.
But Ned, another way to say this, maybe for those who haven't, I mean, this is good because many of us screamed for 3 years about this issue. So I think that the fair way to say it is it doesn't require anything that's not monotonic. What you're doing is just, you don't require there any non-monotonicity in the evolution.
Right, but you know, I mean, it's a lot simpler than that. You know,
yeah, I understand.
Anyway, so I just wanted to point out here, this red arrow points out where the universe switched from decelerating to accelerating. It's right here. No, it's not at the crossover. It's here. It did happen, but you can't point to that crossover or to this high redshift supernova and say, now we've proven that. Okay. So this is the evolution that you require to go from the Einstein de Sitter model to the concordance model. As you can see, it's monotonic, Lars's point here. But, you know, you can make this even simpler by plotting it versus cosmic time instead of redshift. Okay, let's plot log of the required evolution versus cosmic time. And it becomes a straight line, practically. And so that model that I have there is just an exponential in cosmic time. So it's an extremely simple model. It could be new physics in the sense of photons oscillating into axions with some percentage per physical distance. Or it could be a steady state gray dust model where you have a constant physical density of gray dust. Not a constant co-moving density, but a constant physical density. Those are equivalent models. Or it could be that the supernovae are evolving. But of course, you don't expect the supernovae to evolve like that, so you could very well, you know, shoot at this model by understanding more about the supernovae, but we don't understand enough about the supernovae to even explain for sure whether they're, you know, accretion-induced collapse or double degenerate, but people are working on that. So we're getting there. And so I'd just like to point out some other things. Sometimes people assume that you actually know omega matter. Well, not from the CMB, that's for sure. CMB tells you omega matter h squared, and I'm going to show you some plots where I assume a certain value for omega matter h squared from that. And then based on that, you can actually then see on this W matter, omega matter versus omega lambda plot, you can have the Hubble constant drawn in as contours on that because of that, and then you can compare it to the Hubble Space Telescope key project value. Same thing applies to this large-scale structure parameter where the big peak in P of K is. That's controlled by omega matter times H. And this is going to be very important because it turns out the interesting questions, which many people I'm sure at the KITP are interested in, about dark energy, things like what is the value of this equation of state parameter, the pressure, you know, divided by rho c squared, if you take the WMAP default cosmology, W equals minus 1, and plot delta dm for that, And then you force W equal to minus 0.9 and adjust omega matter and omega x to get a best fit. You get a damn good fit. In fact, it's only plus or minus 2 millimagnitudes away. And that's not going to be measurable, ever. So if we want to determine anything about W, we're going to have many other forms of information besides the supernova. So we can pin down omega matter and omega lambda, or omega x. If it's W is not equal to minus 1, then it doesn't make sense to call it omega lambda. Okay. And of course, W prime is even worse. Now it's 1 millimagnitude.
We should translate 1 millimag into...
1 millimagnitude is a tenth of a percent. Thank you, Lars. So that means you have to measure the brightness of an object that's extremely faint relative to an object that's 10,000 or 100,000 times brighter. You have to get that brightness ratio accurate to a tenth of a percent.
And it's not evolution.
And it could be evolution. Okay. So we need non-supernova data. So we're going to need the CMB. We need a better CMB experiment, and that's likely to happen. WMAP now has 3 years of data. And Planck, if it works, will be lots better. And then I'd just like to point out something else. A lot of people have been trying to fit W and W prime. Well, if W is not equal to minus 1, it makes no sense when analyzing the large-scale structure and the CMB to consider it to be a simple function of redshift. It's going to be a dynamical thing. It will respond to gravitational forces. And it will affect gravitationally the motion of galaxies and photons. So you need to allow for that, you know, what Paul Steinhardt called quintessence, in figuring out what the CMB is telling you and also what the large-scale structure is telling you. So here's a few charts. Omega lambda should be omega x because W is minus 0.7 here. Now the supernova fit is up here. And CMB is telling you this. If you go to where the CMB and the supernovae are consistent here, now you're not flat. So as you shift W, this idea that the universe is flat gets wrong. So if you assume the universe is flat because you get a good concordance model when W is equal to minus 1 and then try to fit for W, you're making a big logical error. Now here's W equals minus 0.9. This is that model that was so close. You can see it's off the CMB. So assuming that there's no dramatic effect on the CMB acoustic peak position, which is probably true, then we could rule that out using CMB data, but not using supernova data. And then similarly for W equals minus 1, you know, the big, I mean, minus 1.1, you know, the big rip. Well, now we're getting into closed universes, but that's not ruled out by the CMB. So I'd just like to point out there's three simplicities, you know, vacuum energy equal to zero, but we've decided we can't hold that anymore. Omega total equals 1, well, we're still holding on that. And then W equals minus 1. This is much simpler than anything else, right? You know, it's Einstein's cosmological constant. But that's not why it's so simple. It's Lorentz invariant. So it's a reasonable property of the vacuum. It doesn't have any dynamics. So it is much simpler. So if you're going to say that W is not equal to minus 1, it'll be a function of space and time. Some field, for sure, whether it's a scalar field or something else, it's got to be figured out what its dynamics are. The assumption that you just have some function of redshift is just plain silly. So to go at this again with PowerPoint art, we were pushed off the Einstein de Sitter model. So now we're off this intersection of two simplicities. And now we're hanging on here at lambda CDM. W equals minus 1 in a flat universe. But when we get pushed off that purple dot, if we get pushed off that purple dot, there's no particular reason to think we're going to get pushed off the W equals minus 1 line in preference to the flat universe line. Either one or both could then fail. So we need to keep track, keep fitting. So we should prove flatness. And so W equals minus 1. Now, we just need to keep checking that. So if we use all data combined, we're probably okay. But we shouldn't be imposing priors on omega total or omega matter, for that matter. You know, these are parameters we have to solve for using the data that we have. So here's my best postscript. I mean, this is postscript art, actually. So if omega equals minus 1, then flat lambda CDM is a good fit to all the data. Hence, if omega equals 1, then W equals minus 1 is a good fit to all of the data. Go around and round. Okay, now I'd just like to make some comments about observational systematic errors. It turns out that, you know, measuring the brightness of a supernova at redshift 2, comparing it to the brightness of a supernova at redshift 0, you actually have to compare a near-infrared flux to an optical flux. And these have to be compared in watts. You know, it doesn't do any good to compare them in magnitudes. You need the watts. And to get the watts, you have to go out with a platinum lamp, a black body, and measure it and compare it to stars. And, you know, if you make one Kelvin error in the temperature of your calibration lamp, that's much bigger than the difference between delta W equal to 0.1. Okay? So that's a completely fatal error, is just this kind of thing. So really, you know, DOE and NASA should get NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, to join the JDEM jointness. And then we have the astrophysical systematic errors. You know, you have gravitational lensing, you have evolution with age of the universe of any of the parameters of the supernovae, and then you have contamination, you know, the usual statistical errors of type 2 supernovae or other kinds, being easier to detect at lower redshifts, so they're less likely to contaminate at low redshift than high redshift, and then gray dust. So just why there's some optimism, you know, let me just explain some new data that's been coming in. Gravitational lensing, people have actually been measuring the redshifts of these arcs in these big clusters of galaxies. So if you have the redshift of many arcs, so you see the arcs forming here, you can actually learn about the geometry of the universe. Because if you have arcs at different radii, those correspond to different distances in the universe. So you have the distance and you have the redshift. So if you have multiple arcs with multiple redshifts, you can actually tell something about the geometry of the universe. And this has been done once, sort of, and this is the contours. Einstein de Sitter is ruled out. And here's the concordance model. It's not the best fit. The best fit would be up here at, you know, zero for the matter density. But, you know, it's consistent with the accelerating universe. And it shows all the CMB, the H-naught data, the lensing data, and the supernova data, and the concordance model. So it does all fit together. So that's useful. And if we then went and got SNAP-like data, suppose we got 1% errors on the distance modulus to 17 bins in redshift from 0 to 1.7. That's what we'd have. So that's not such a dramatic improvement, is it? So you don't see that graph from the SNAP crowd. And I'd like to say, you know, there's more data coming in, late integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, ISW. This is the change in the gravitational potential in clusters of galaxies, superclusters, when you have a lambda not equal to zero. Then the gravitational potential decreases as the universe expands. And that causes a change in the energy of a photon. So this effect peaks for galaxies near redshift 0.6. And it was undetected. The COBE map did not show a correlation with the radio source counts. Large-scale structure did not correlate with the COBE map. And that was a 2-sigma discrepancy between all these concordance models and everything. But when WMAP came along, we actually now find the expected correlation. So you see the correlation between WMAP and large-scale structure. You also see it with the hard X-ray background. And that says that this concordance model is about right. The super sandage model down here is just wrong. I mean, the Einstein de Sitter and sort of the best fit to the CMB power spectrum both have zero effect here. That's because what's missing, the missing power at L equals 2 in the WMAP power spectrum was in the COBE power spectrum too. would be one of the signals of this late integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And we don't see that, but we do see the correlation with the large-scale structure. So we could convolve this, compare this map to infrared galaxy counts. This is the two-mass map, and that's better. But two-mass doesn't go far enough, doesn't reach redshift 0.6. So it only goes to a redshift around 0.1. And so then I'm working on the WISE project, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, should launch in 2008. And this is just a pretty picture stuck in for no particular reason, but it's the two-mass galaxies with estimated redshifts. So the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer will survey the sky in four bands from 3 to 24 microns. It's now in phase B, and if we don't get canceled, it will fly in 2008. And it will be able to measure galaxies out to redshift 0.6 and beyond. On the latest, I heard at the AAS meeting, was baryonic oscillations being picked up by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So here's the two-point correlation function of galaxies multiplied by r squared to flatten it out. There's a peak here at 100 H inverse megaparsecs. This is exactly the same peak that we see in the microwave background fluctuations. But now we can measure its angular size, not at a redshift of 1,000, but a redshift of 1/3. And so we actually have a measurement that depends much less on the vacuum energy density than the CMB. So we got a crossing line when we're doing our fits. So this is what the baryonic oscillations tell us. Okay, almost an omega matter measurement. And then as we go through the different values, you can see, now things haven't changed dramatically, but this is quite a narrow line. It's much better at constraining these parameters than the supernova data are now. And it's about as good as the SNAP data would be. So baryonic oscillations are a very powerful tool for understanding dark energy. So just to conclude, the dark energy is fact. And both the supernovae and strong lensing, late ISW effect, I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons for believing in dark energy. But the discussions of dark energy that you see in the literature are almost all science fiction. So they'll convert, have hidden assumptions, they just don't say it, or they assume that because the universe is flat by the CMB, but only if W equals minus 1, they'll convert that to a prior, and then do an analysis and say, wait a minute, W is equal to minus 1. We've shown that. So that's double and triple counting the CMB. And so just a few more jokes. Yeah, that was my mistake too. And luckily, of course, especially for all those who are coming out to dinner with us, we should drink enough to be able to see these things. And now here's my homage to Stephen Hawking. A lot of people have found all sorts of strange things in this WMAP map. So the strangest, however, is indicated here. And so that's just got to be Stephen Hawking. So that SH has just got to be Stephen Hawking written large on the sky. And I'll close with these end notes. You may have seen the footnotes there, but that's... Okay, thanks.
Question?
Gary? So you said that WMAP now has 3 years of data.
Three and a half.
Three and a half. Has anything but the first year data been released?
No.
No.
Has been published? No. Has it been analyzed? Many times.
Other questions?
Bill.
So you're not a fan of SNAP for measuring
W? I'm not a fan of putting all our eggs in the supernova basket. I am a fan of SNAP, the 2-meter telescope with a big wide field camera that works into the near infrared and has a spectrograph. I'm a complete fan of that. Okay? That instrument will tell us so much about the universe, but most of what it tells us about the universe, some of it will come from measuring a bunch of supernovae, but most of it won't. So I think it's a good thing to build. It's just, you know, needs to be tweaked a little bit.
So what would you do? Size API and more?
Well, basically what you need to do is you have to work more in the infrared. You know, so snap goes to about 1.4 microns. You should work further into the infrared because you need to be able to study these baryonic oscillations and other things in galaxies, which are a lot redder than supernovae, to pretty high redshift. So that's one of the most valuable things you could do with this big wide field telescope. And you really need to set it up so it can do more spectroscopy, because spectroscopy is hard and you want to do more of it, especially if you want to do baryonic oscillations. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, you know, that was about 50,000 galaxies, density of 16 per square degree. But if you wanted to do that at redshift 2, you'd have to be doing 1,000 or more galaxies per square degree. That'd be a lot fainter. And so you'd need many, many more galaxies, and they'd be fainter. So you really need to be able to do a lot of galaxy redshifts.